This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending the 23rd of March 2012. Hello and welcome to the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper with extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle for the week ending the 23rd of March, which this week have been edited by Margaret Boyden and Linda Vincent. Your readers today are Jane Harding.
Hello.
Graham Cranmer.
Hello.
And Bobby Sanderson.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter, Keith Vincent. Now, this week's announcements, we start with What's On. There are a few items. Winchester certainly will be having several events in May which you might want to start booking for. These are specifically to celebrate the Queen's Diamond Jubilee. And we start with Mayfest, which brings concerts, sessions and ceilidhs to Winchester's streets, pubs and arts venues for two vibrant days of folk, jazz, roots and blues in May. This is on Friday the 25th and Saturday the 26th of May. And they seem to run from 10 a.m. on the Friday through till 11 p.m. on the Saturday. And that's in and around Winchester High Street. Now, our local literary biographer Claire Tomlin discusses the life and work of one of our best and most influential novelists, Charles Dickens. This is the bicentenary year of his birth. And that's at Guildhall at Winchester on Saturday the 26th of May. And that's between 6 p.m. and 10 p.m. In the Guildhall, there's a county service of thanksgiving for the Queen's Diamond Jubilee. Winchester Cathedral will commemorate this special occasion with a county service of thanksgiving. That's at 11 a.m. on Sunday the 27th of May. And that's as part of the lead-up to the national celebrations. And there's a live BBC radio recording with Martin Jarvis on Just William. And you can hear him read and record two hilarious Just William short stories and meet Martin Jarvis afterwards. This is on Sunday the 27th of May, 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. And that's the Theatre Royal at Winchester. The Theatre Royal box office is Winchester 840440. And the Chesil Theatre presents Heroes by Gerald Ciblera, translated by Tom Stoppard and directed by Caroline Helk. The performances are from March the 26th to the 31st at 7:45 p.m. with a matinee on Saturday the 31st at 2:30 p.m. Heroes is set in France in 1959 with three veterans from the First World War vigorously combating the boredom of life in a home for retired soldiers. So, there's a plan to break out? Crazy? Of course. Comical? Frequently. Heroic? We'll leave you to decide. Now, there's a notice from RNIB about claiming all your tax allowances. And RNIB has set up a new tax advice service to help blind and partially sighted people claim all the tax allowances to which they're entitled. Many people think that when they retire they stop paying tax, but this might not be the case. You may be paying tax on your earnings, a works pension, or on the interest on your savings. But the good news is, by claiming all your tax allowances, you can reduce the amount of tax you pay. Everyone can receive a certain amount of income in any one year without having to pay income tax. But you may also be entitled to the Blind Person's Allowance, which is a very specific tax benefit for people who are registered blind or severely sight impaired. The Blind Person's Allowance for the tax year 2012-13 is £2,100 and there are no age or income restrictions. Once claimed, it will carry on into future tax years. Even if you don't pay any tax, you can transfer the blind person's allowance to your husband, wife or civil partner to reduce their tax, whether or not they're blind. And there's also a married couple's allowance that can reduce the tax bill for couples where one of you was born before the 6th of April 1935. HM Revenue and Customs, or HMRC, has a priority telephone number to help people with sight loss to claim these allowances. The number is 0845 366 7887. That's customs and revenue and customs. 0845 366 7887. It's easy to apply. Most claims can be taken over the phone, and there are usually no forms to complete. All you need when you phone is your national insurance number and details of your income. But also, if you have any questions about tax, you can call the RNIB on 0845 330 4897. Now, lighting up time ends today, March the 23rd at 6:01 a.m. and begins at 6:25 p.m. On Wednesday the 28th of March, it ends at 6:50 a.m. and begins at 7:33 p.m. And note the change of time. That, of course, is because the clocks go forward 1 hour this weekend on the early hours of Sunday morning. If you have any problems with your recording, please contact Lynn Parker on 01962 862 826. And don't forget, if you don't wish to listen to any particular item on the recording, just skip forward to the next track by pressing the forward button on the top of your Sapphire player. Now, the main headlines this week. Mum died days after giving birth to triplets. Sydney is the bearer of good news. And £27 million spent on council redundancies. So, Jane, may we have the story behind the first headline, please?
The first headline is Mum died days after giving birth to triplets. She had been on top of the world in the little time she had with them. That was how a Winchester father described his wife, who collapsed and died in hospital just days after giving birth to triplets. Medical staff fought desperately in vain to save Isabel Masson, who fell ill just 8 days after giving birth to Matthias, Lucas and Sarah. Her husband, Paul, told the Hampshire Chronicle on Tuesday how the couple had looked forward to bringing up their children together before the tragedy happened. Isabel, known as Izzy, was an IT project worker for Ordnance Survey in Southampton, where her husband also works in the products department. The 34-year-old of Tegdown Meads Week died on March the 10th in the Royal Hampshire County Hospital in Winchester, having given birth there on March the 2nd. Isabel had delivered healthy triplets, Matthias, Lucas and Sarah, and in the precious week in between had been on top of the world, said Mr. Mason. We were both overjoyed to be having an instant family. The triplets were our first and most probably our last children. Mr. Mason said since Isabel's death he had been overwhelmed with messages of support and tributes to his wife. We would like to thank all our friends and colleagues who have been in touch, as these words of comfort and kindness mean so much to our family, he said. Mrs. Mason was born in East Germany in 1977, but at 18 travelled to England to work as an au pair, and after periods in Germany, France and America, returned to the UK. She began working at the Ordnance Survey as part of an IS project management team in 2008, which was how she and Paul met. They married in June 2010. A spokesman for Ordnance Survey said, "Our thoughts are with Paul, the babies, and the wider families of both Isabel and Paul at this very sad time." An inquest has been opened and adjourned into Isabel's death. It heard that the possible cause of death was hemopericardium, which is when blood leaks into the sac surrounding the heart from a cut in an artery. A spokesman on behalf of Hampshire Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust, which runs the Royal Hampshire County Hospital, said, "This is a real tragedy, and our thoughts and sincere condolences are with the family who we are supporting at this difficult time." And the article is accompanied by a photo of Isabel Mason with her husband Paul before the tragic event.
And the next headline is Sydney is the bearer of good news. So who is Sydney? He's an 86-year-old charity stalwart who will be among those carrying the Olympic torch through the streets of Winchester and Hampshire this summer. Sydney Dean, from Swanmore. He said, "I'm like a child waiting for Christmas. It cannot come soon enough. I couldn't believe it when I found out. Mr. Dean will carry the torch through Boscombe." Peter Simmons' student, Kirsty Nash, is among those chosen to bear the torch on July the 11th in Winchester. Kirsty, of Fleming Place, Colden Common, is a young carer for her sister Sophie, who's 21, and who has epilepsy, cerebral palsy and autism. Henry Beaufort pupil Sam Smith, who's 14, of Maple Drive, Kingsworthy, has been selected to carry the torch in Gosport. He lost the use of his legs in October 2010 due to conversion disorder, a medical condition that left him in a wheelchair. After 6 months of treatment at the Burslington House unit in Southampton, he's now able to walk again, aiming to be able to jog by July. University of Winchester student Chloe Bond, who's 21, of Cromwell Road, Stanmore, will carry the torch in her home county of Essex on July the 6th. Chloe was nominated for her volunteer work in Asia and South America, as well as with Girl Guides in Winchester. Students from St Bede Primary School and Peter Simmons College were at the launch of the Olympic torch route in Winchester on Monday, where they also promoted the 2012 Personal Bests event on June the 27th. More than 2,000 children from primary schools across Winchester are expected to take part in Olympic-themed sports at Winchester Sports Stadium at Bar End. And there is a picture of Sydney Dean, joined by pupils from Peter Simmons College and St Bede Primary School, including Will Short, who's there next to him, and Angelina Gibson, who's a smaller little girl on the other side. And there's a whole crowd of them behind, holding up sort of replicas, I suppose, and banners of the Olympic torch. Very happy to have been chosen.
£27 million spent on council redundancies. 83 staff members walk away with between £40,000 and £66,000. Hampshire County Council is forking out more than £27 million of taxpayers' money on redundancy packages. 83 staff made redundant received between £40,000 and £66,000 to leave the council. And the average payout for the 868 employees who lost their jobs was £20,589, twice as high as in the private sector. The biggest known cheque went to the economic development boss, Alison Quant, who was handed £79,582 when she left her post last year. Anti-council tax campaigners have criticised the redundancy payoffs, which are above the statutory minimum. But county bosses said the move would save the council £46 million by April 2014, and then £32 million per year, which justified the upfront cost. In total, more than £17.5 million of taxpayers' money will be spent on redundancy payments, and £9.9 million on pension top-ups during 2010-2013. Council staff aged 55 plus, who are made redundant, are entitled to start claiming their local authority pension. The authority has axed 1,469 full-time equivalent posts as part of plans to save £100 million over 2 years. and more jobs are set to go as part of a drive to cut costs across the organisation. More than 800 employees opted for an enhanced voluntary redundancy scheme. There were only 16 compulsory redundancies, including 3 senior managers. In addition, the council cut 600 jobs by freezing vacant posts. The figures were revealed in a report to the Employment in Hampshire County Council Committee. According to the report, 165 senior managers on salaries above £43,000 took voluntary redundancy. 439 supervisory staff earning between £23,000 and £43,000, and also 263 lower paid employees. Under legal statutory redundancy guidelines, a manager aged 50 on a £75,000 a year salary who worked at the council for 15 years would get just £7,800. Under Hampshire's compulsory scheme, this rises to £28,000. But under enhanced terms, they can leave with £56,000. Payouts are capped at 40 weeks' salary. Christine Melson, the coordinator of Is It Fair? Anti-Council Tax Group, said, "If the council had paid the statutory minimum, I could have understood. But these huge redundancy payments are just not acceptable or affordable. Taxpayers have to shoulder the burden of these huge sums and on top of that, pay the pensions strain. The council should be looking to reduce council tax." The county said its voluntary redundancy terms are about average for Hampshire local authorities and significantly less generous than the NHS or the civil service. Conservative council boss Councillor Ken Thornburgh said, "Had we chosen to implement widespread compulsory redundancies, this would have caused significant disruption across the organisation and our services, as has been seen elsewhere. It would also have cost us in terms of additional management time, human resources and legal costs." Emma Boone, who's the campaign director of the Taxpayers Alliance, said, "Councils have to make big savings in the coming years, and unfortunately that might mean some redundancies. In the long term, this will make savings, but only if payouts are fair to departing staff and taxpayers. In many cases, it's hard to justify deals that are more generous than the statutory ones that many private sector workers were offered when they were laid off in the recession. Many taxpayers will find it incredible that one person can walk away from a job with a voluntary redundancy payment worth more than 3 times the average annual salary."
Thank you. That concludes the headline stories. So now before we go with general news, we've got the death announcements, Christian comment, letters, historical items, the editorial comment and first person. So we'll start with the announcements of deaths in this week's Chronicle. Brown, Frederick James Brown, died peacefully in hospital aged 94. Caulfield, Dawn Caulfield, died peacefully on the 15th of March. D. Rosemary Ann D. of Easton, died peacefully on the 14th of March. Foster, Noreen Mary Foster, known as Nonny, died peacefully in hospital aged 86. Freeman, Stella May Freeman, died peacefully on the 14th of March in hospital at Swindon. Green, Alfred George Green, peacefully on the 14th of March, aged 69. Hassel, James Stewart Hassel, who was a warrant officer class 1 of the Wildcat fielding team, who met an untimely death on a motorcycle accident in Oxford, aged 36. Jacob, Sandra Mary Jacob, died on the 12th of March. Lawson, Harold Vernon Lawson, died on the 1st of March, aged 95. Mitten, Alice Mitten, died peacefully in hospital, aged 90. Page, Robert Page, died on the 18th of March at Romsey, aged 96. Robinson, Albert Robinson, died peacefully at home, aged 85. Tudor, Hilary Tudor, died peacefully in Torrington, Devon, aged 83. Wells, Mary Wells, formerly of Hinton Ampner, died on the 18th of March, aged 65. Wiseman, Florence Emily Wiseman, died peacefully on the 16th of March, aged 98. And lastly, sadly, we have to tell you of the death of one of our long-term listeners, Ruth Faulkner, who died at the grand old age of 102. And now, Bobby's going to read Christian comment. Bobby.
And this week's Christian comment is offered by Mary Gray. And she heads it, Litmus Test of the Big Society. Many will have reacted to the news that Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, is to step down at the end of the year to move to an academic post in Cambridge, with genuine pleasure that this eminent scholar will have a chance to develop his writing in relative calm. But they shouldn't assume that his critique of society will come to an abrupt end. As the Sunday Times of March the 18th announced that he would use his last months in office to, quote, wage war on the government for its vision for British society. But doesn't the government have a unique vision for society called the Big Society? Isn't it meant to be a compassionate, connected society, engaging local communities in issues vital to our flourishing? The Big Society was meant to engage with disenchantment and apathy with regards to politics and politicians, and with the polarity of state control versus individual initiative. But what is the reality? It is that we have failed to create a financial system where the strong fend for the weak, and where cuts in social services and unemployment are creating growing misery in many parts of the country, particularly among young people. This should be a clarion call to all our churches. One of the dominant images of church throughout the ages is koinonia, or community. Before the welfare state was established, it was the churches and monastic communities that took responsibility for the poor and vulnerable, that is, before the dissolution of the monasteries. Prison reform was the initiative of the Quakers, and 19th century Christian philanthropy addressed poverty, education, and health. Even today, there are Christian initiatives for housing. Emmaus was originally founded by the Abbé Pierre in Paris, and communities for people with impairment, like Lush. In America, peace activist Dorothy Day founded the Catholic worker movement in the 20th century, establishing 80 houses for the homeless, vagrants, and unemployed, and these still flourish. When she was asked how long people were allowed to stay, she answered, Oh, we let them stay forever. They live with us. They die with us. Once they are taken in, they become members of the family and are our brothers and sisters in Christ. Now, this seems to be the big vision that the big society misses. Christianity in this country no longer has a dominant position, but it does not need to lose sight of the founding inspiration of the inclusive kingdom of God, of peace and justice, or to forget its role of challenging the government and recalling it to its avowed responsibilities to the most vulnerable people. They are the litmus test of the big society.
Thank you. Now we continue with letters to the editor. Jane, can you start us off, please?
The first letter is from Anne Clough of Hatherley Road, Full Flood in Winchester, and is headed College's Proposal, Mark's Watershed. Sir, I live in Hatherley Road, Winchester, and I am writing with reference to your article, Residents Close Ranks Over Plan for Old Armoury, Hampshire Chronicle, March the 15th. There is a very real concern that the planning application by Peter Simmons College to build two new classrooms on their boundary with Hatherley Road marks a watershed in the development of the college. Building here would set a significant precedent at odds with previous planning refusal to develop this side of the campus. Peter Simmons student numbers have more than doubled in recent years, now around 4,000 students, which inevitably impacts on the surrounding residential area. All permanent teaching facilities are currently on the northern boundary, with some 120 metres of open amenity land between most college activity and a quiet residential road. Breaching this natural green buffer would bring the college to our doorsteps. The traditional good relationship between the college and Hatherley Road residents is being stretched by this proposal, which we feel to be inappropriate in scale, design and location. Whilst, as you reported, there were only 9 letters of objection, one of them carried 29 signatures, so there were 38 objections in total. And that was Anna Clough.
This letter is from Claire Welland, who's a parish councillor of School Lane, Headbourne Worthy, Winchester. Sir, I would like to correct Jeff Bruty. Letters, March the 8th. Winchester City Councillor Keith Wood does represent Sparshalt. However, his ward includes Headbourne Worthy, one of the parishes on the boundary of the proposed Barton Farm scheme. Headbourne Worthy Parish Council has consistently opposed Carla Holmes' plans and is very concerned about a disproportionately large housing development just across the railway line from a small rural village. Councillor Wood's vote was not representative of the parish council's position. Claire Welland, School Lane, Headbourne Worthy, Winchester.
And now a letter from Phil Gagg. City could rival Bath or Oxford. Sir, I fully support Tony Wyman's plea to stop through traffic in St George's Street. That was in the letters of March the 15th. Let's do a good job of it as part of the town access plan. Shared space will be possible only if traffic volumes reduce considerably. We will need 1. Two-way traffic on North Walls. 2. A Dutch system of discrete service in loops that defeats through traffic and rack runners. 3. Extensive surface and junction treatment. 4. Facilities for buses and bikes. 5. A major reduction in city centre parking. And finally, better marketing of the park and ride scheme. Similar treatment could be applied to High Street above Jury Street. These steps will transform Winchester into a national destination of choice, on a par with Oxford and Bath. I cannot support his views on the high street market. He undervalues the quality of the stalls, 2 award winners and more to follow. He overvalues the quality of the shops, many are lacklustre, and his disregard for overwhelming public opinion is worrying. It's clear that the market attracts trade, and BID's claim, despite the evidence of all credit for the footfall increase, is neither rigorous nor even in their own interest. There is a great and historically appropriate opportunity to extend the street market to enliven the square and block a polluting rat run. That's from Phil Gagg of Fairfield Road, Full Flood, Winchester.
And Elizabeth Thorne writes that not all cities can boast a cathedral. Sir, there has been recent confirmation of my assertion in your pages of about 3 years ago that a town with a cathedral is not necessarily a city, and that not all cities have cathedrals. I refer to the elevation to city status of Chelmsford, Perth, and St. Asaph, each of which has a cathedral, but they were obviously not cities, or else why would they have applied and now been granted city status? Chelmsford City Football Club is now correct in its name, though it wasn't before. Cambridge is a city, having been granted that status years ago, even though it has no cathedral. And that was Elizabeth Thorne, Airlie Lane, Winchester.
This letter is from Councillor Ken Thornburgh, who is the leader of Hampshire County Council, from the Castle, Winchester. Sir, I would like to respond to comments made by 2 members of the Winchester City Residents Association in the recent article Discovery Centre Not a Good Library, which came out on March the 8th, and in a letter from Rosemary Conway, also of the Winchester City Residents Association, on March the 15th, in which she repeats her original concerns. While we welcome comments and feedback on the quality of our local service, claims that the Discovery Centre is not a good library and that it fails to maximise natural light is not the message we get from the very positive feedback we receive on a regular basis from the thousands who make Winchester Discovery Centre the most well-used library in Hampshire. Users enjoy the light, airy feel to the building, which has also been confirmed by contractors in their assessment that the lighting is more than adequate. The bright, modern, accessible and innovative design, meanwhile, is one of the things that visitors remark makes the centre unique and easy to navigate. More people take out books, CDs and DVDs from the city's Discovery Centre than from any other library in the county. And by installing new self-service machines, we are encouraging even greater numbers to visit in future to use this quick and easy way of borrowing. In moving the Classics section last May, we have provided more shelf space to classic literature and improved the lighting. We regularly promote the classics to highlight their prominence and literary importance to attract all visitors to this genre. A recent example was the display of our new Charles Dickens's titles to celebrate the recent 200th anniversary of the author's birth. We have no evidence to suggest customers cannot find the classics section, and have staff on hand to assist if required. Far from being in a dark area, the section is at the heart of the Discovery Centre, on the direct route between the cafe, fiction shelves, performance hall and the atrium area, and benefits from frequent passing customers. Claims that the library is marginalising classic literature by putting it in badly lit areas are, therefore, simply not the case. Councillor Ken Thornber is leader of the Hampshire County Council.
This letter is headed, A Job Well Done. Sir, may I congratulate the councils and Mildren Construction on such a fine refurbishment. The paving in High Street, now extended through to the square, has greatly enhanced Winchester city centre. The Colour Factory should also be praised for their beautiful artwork on the bollards. It's so nice to see them restored as well. Local authorities sometimes get a lot of flack, but I would like to commend the highways team for a job so well done. Both the design and the workmanship is excellent. Would it be too much to hope that residents and visitors will show their appreciation by keeping the streets clean and putting their rubbish, including chewing gum, in the nearest litter bin? Chris Higgins, St James Terrace, Winchester.
And Carolyn Seligman writes a letter headed, Dairy Farm That's Flourishing on Winchester's Doorstep. Sir, with regard to your article in last week's Hampshire Chronicle, Another Dairy Farmer Calls Time, your readers may be interested to know they have a dairy farm just 4 miles from Winchester. New Barn Farm Crawley was purchased by my father, Douglas Seligman, in 1933 and was run as a mixed farm, arable and dairy, until his death in 1994. At one time he farmed some 4,000 acres in the locality. Since 1995, a smaller farm of just 650 acres has been run by his daughter, Carolyn Seligman, together with the team at New Barn Farm. The farm is still mixed, with some arable and a dairy herd of approximately 200 cows, producing 1.6 million litres of milk a year. New Barn Farm won the first prize at the Hampshire Farms competition in 2011 for the dairy class. And Carolyn Seligman's letter from New Barn Farm Crawley is accompanied by a photograph of some of the black and white cows at the farm.
Claudia Goss writes from Heatherley Road, Full Flood, Winchester, under the heading Population Growth Must Be Addressed. Sir, it was worrying to read last week's comment, cramming towns is the only option. In the short term, this may be the case, as housing is desperately needed. But in the longer term, there is another option, stabilising the population level of this crowded isle. In 2008, England overtook Holland as most densely populated major country in Europe, with 395 per square kilometre, almost double that of Germany and four times France. This is estimated to rise to 464 by 2031 from the Office of National Statistics, concentrated in the south and east. We also have, on average, the smallest homes at 818 square feet in the UK, compared with 1,216 square feet in France. Plans to replace two homes in Stanmore with nine suggest this is only going to get worse. In 2009, a report by the Commission for Architecture and the Built Environment said private homes built today were already, quotes, too small for everyday life, unquote. Population has to be addressed if we are to maintain and improve people's quality of life. Claudia Goss, Heatherley Road, Full Flood.
The Hampshire County Council has sold off a jewel in the crown, so writes Peter Rees. Sir, the decision by Hampshire County Council to award the contract for Sure Start Children's Centres to a private company marks the end of a period when the needs of the vulnerable under fives and their families were at last being met. The service has been sold for £9 million to the lowest bidder, and a bounty of £1 million found for the county. Action for Children's record is not good. It lost three national contracts, East Sussex, Plymouth and Wilts, and the children's centre it manages in Basingstoke was deemed unsatisfactory. Staff have already begun to leave. This is the start of a deliberate rundown of individual community centre-based services. TUP Ed staff will not have any guarantees about job security after transfer. Terms and conditions will be considerably less than those at present. This is already an extension of the model of selling public services for private profit, profit that will not be ploughed back into public service. A4C will not invest in these centres, and they will be run with the minimum service delivery. This decision is nothing short of disgraceful at a time when all the research evidence shows that early intervention in vulnerable children's lives makes a difference. And it is also a decision that could have been completely avoided. We are encouraged to embrace the big society and localism. But Hampshire County Council has sold off a jewel in the crown, completely disregarding local people and their wishes. They have made profit available for private enterprise, as is happening in other public services. This very bad decision will disadvantage the most disadvantaged children and families, especially when evidence shows that the previous model was at last working and making a difference to their lives. So writes Peter Rees of Monarch Way, Winchester.
Thank you. That concludes the letters. Now we're going to step back in time. Jane, 200 years?
Well, 200 years ago, in 1812. On Thursday last, a child, about four, was killed in Southgate Street by a wagon belonging to Mr. Barber of Southampton, the wheel of which passed over its head while in the act of taking up a hoop he had driven under the wagon. At an inquest, no carelessness could be imputed to the driver, who did all he could to prevent it. Jury brought in a verdict of accidental death, fining the wagon owner 1 shilling. And this morning, Julien Dubois and Guillaume Berry were taken from the county jail to the place of execution, and a little before nine were launched into eternity. They had conducted themselves with the greatest propriety since sentence and appeared resigned to their fate. When officers went to their cells this morning soon after five, they discovered they had attempted to bleed themselves to death with a sharpened nail. The surgeon of the prison was immediately sent for and the effusion of blood stopped.
We leap straight to 50 years ago, 1962. Now, Hampshire County Council have decided on 4 Marks bypass. It is, quotes, extremely unlikely, unquote, the original £436,000 route selected will be changed. The route, cheapest of four considered last year, will be 2.35 miles long, and consist of dual carriageways, each 24 feet wide, with a central reservation. It will leave the A31 Alton to Winchester Road by the Shant Public House and cut across country to south of the old chalk pit with a flyover at Barn Lane.
Nearer our time, 25 years ago, 1987, 2 items... Winchester City Council wants to hear from anyone with a need for several hundred tons of rubble. The hardcore has come from the central car park, which is being dug up so archaeologists can study the site before it is developed. Assistant City Archaeologist and Site Director Mike Morris says it would be ideal for making a farm track or foundation for a barn, but there's only one snag. Anyone who can use the rubble must be willing to take delivery straight away, as the City Council is having to clear the site as quickly as possible. And the second item, Hampshire Fire Brigade is taking part in a national campaign to encourage people to install smoke detectors in their homes. Chief Fire Officer John Pearson revealed on Wednesday that 28 people died in fires in the county last year, compared to 17 the previous year. His annual report also shows that 10 deaths occurred during 1986 as a result of children playing with matches and other materials.
Thank you. That's the historical items, and now we move on to Chronicle editorial comment.
The editorial comment is headed, "Generous goodbyes are out of touch." Few other examples give a better insight into the way taxpayers' money can be squandered than the recent redundancy payouts at Hampshire County Council. The county forked out more than £27 million in generous redundancy and pension top-up packages, with a privileged 83 people walking away with between £40,000 and £66,000 each. One worker left a county post with a staggering £79,582, whilst on average 868 others who lost their jobs received £20,589. Not surprisingly, anti-council tax campaigners and the rest of those inhabiting the real world have criticised the payoffs, which are above the statutory minimum. County bosses say the move will save the council £46 million by April 2014 and then £32 million per year, which justified the upfront cost. Council staff aged 55 plus who were made redundant are also entitled to start claiming their local authority gold-plated pensions. The authority has axed 1,469 full-time equivalent posts as part of plans to save £100 million over 2 years. More than 800 opted for an enhanced voluntary redundancy scheme. Now we know why. Those in the private sector have seen their pensions and redundancy terms slashed in recent years. They will be asking why these workers can still enjoy generous goodbyes at their expense.
And now we come to first person. This is written this week by Khalid Aziz, and he entitles it "Heavy Hand of the Law." This is not a good time to be a policeman. Leave aside the Leveson inquiry, which started out looking into alleged misdemeanours by the gutter press, but has swept into its ambit a number of high-profile police officers. For example, what was Met Commissioner Sir Paul Stevenson thinking of when he accepted several weeks at Champneys, free of charge, to recuperate from an injured leg? Never mind the fact that News International executive editor Neil Wallace was working there at the time, later to be arrested as part of Operation Wheating. It looks like there'll be more to come on the links between the police and the Murdoch Empire. Then there are the newly created police commissioners we shall joyfully trot to the polling stations to elect this autumn. Predictably, the political parties are putting forward their own candidates, when one would have thought this was a classic job for someone demonstrably free of political leanings. At least in our neck of the woods, we'll be free of the ennui of John Prescott explaining why he has the right credentials for the job. I suppose some will argue that He has an interesting version of swift justice when it comes to cases of assault, particularly where eggs are concerned. Now, a review from Tom Windsor, the former rail regulator, covers 1,100 pages and, among other things, proves that all the alleged hospitality has taken its toll on the Plod waistline. According to Windsor, 52% of Met officers are overweight and 22% of them obese. Predictably, the Police Federation has sprung to the defence of its members, muttering about a sustained attack by the government. New York's finest are often referred to as the Donut Squad. Looks like our boys in blue could give them a run for their money. Or perhaps not. As if an attack on waistlines was not enough, Windsor suggests cutting the starting salaries of PCs by £4,500, citing the fact that many more people apply than there are jobs to be filled. There are other reforms too. It should be possible to enter the service at levels other than police constable. This has great merit, for it could be argued that cosiness with the press and the ability not to see that accepting £12,000 worth of health spa accommodation is symptom of a service that has lost touch with reality. An infusion of talent and experience at senior levels might be one way of countering this trend. What Tom Windsor has made clear is that the police, like so many of our institutions, has to be able to change. But some things never change. Public expectations, for example. We want our police to be able to catch criminals. Occasionally, this might involve a bit of a sprint. Let's hope when it all kicks off, we have at our service one of the 50% who are not overweight.
Thank you. Now we continue with items of general news from the Chronicle. Bobby.
This one's headed, Hampshire countryside is springing into action. I would imagine so on a lovely day like today. With winter coming to a close, this time of the year is when Hampshire's beautiful countryside really springs into life. And there's plenty to enjoy for those looking to head outdoors. Whether it's a family day out to enjoy fine views, have a picnic, barbecue or bike ride, or somewhere to walk the dog, the County Council's 7 country parks and almost 3,000 miles of rights of way provide a variety of landscapes. Hills and heaths, forest and downland, rivers and streams, water meadows and woods. Leap Country Park now also offers the opportunity to enjoy Hampshire's newest local nature reserve and site of importance for nature conservation at Leap Point in the New Forest. Formerly privately owned, the site was purchased by the council to protect it from development. And as part of this work, we unveiled the new reserve earlier this year. It provides a protected habitat for wildlife in the coastal, meadow and woodland areas and offers excellent facilities for bird watchers to spot some of the waders and wildfowl that thrive nearby. Leap also offers a spectacular view and opportunities to access the Solent Coast. For something a little different, there's the chance to see what springtime farming was like during the 1940s with a trip to Manor Farm Country Park, where filming is taking place in April for the latest instalment of the BBC's popular Victorian Farm and Edwardian Farm series, entitled this time wartime farm. Meanwhile, for today's busy farmers, it's a busy time on our farms. The council has 2,332 hectares, or if you prefer it, just over 5,000 acres of estate, made up of dairy farms, livestock farms, horticulture, arable farming land, and one equestrian unit. Annually, around a kilometre of new hedgerows are planted, and the size of county holdings puts the county council in the top 20 of local authority farm landowners. Hampshire's farm estate evolved after the First World War as a result of the need to produce more food and provide ex-servicemen with employment in the growth area of agriculture. And while times have changed, we continue to place great value on the importance of the county's rural economy, small towns and villages, and the vital role of farms and farmers across Hampshire. Through careful management of our estate, it produces over 7 million litres of milk each year, and all the sweet corn for our school meals, amongst the many other products and public benefits. In the current financial climate, these opportunities for tenant farmers are helping them to develop their careers through means such as diversification and local food production. In addition, improved links with schools and colleges are being explored to expand education and learning and promote a greater understanding of farming and food among our young people.
And this article is entitled Artist's Tribute to Pat. A Winchester artist has created a glowing tribute to a woman who spent her life helping others. Last Sunday, a new stained glass window was unveiled at St John the Baptist Church, North Baddersley, to keep alive the memory of Pat Minchinton. The window was designed by Sophie Hacker, pictured above, artist in residence at Winchester Cathedral, and features a sun motif constructed from three thorn-like shapes, evoking both a crown of thorns and the Trinity. Below this is a river that flows from top to bottom of the window, representing the waters of baptism. There is also a flaming tree, evoking the Holy Spirit, and a hand of God. The window was paid for with a bequest from Pat, whom many in the village remember for her efforts to set up the Dial a Ride community transport scheme and for her work with the guides. She worshipped at St John's Church for 46 years and was chairman of the Companions of St John. The window was dedicated at a special service conducted by the Bishop of Southampton, the Right Reverend Jonathan Frost. Both the Mayor of Test Valley and the Mayor of Romsey attended. Known affectionately to many as Miss Dial-a-Ride, Pat died in December 2008, aged 79. She was an administrator of the Southern Test Valley Voluntary Transport Scheme with Romsey Dial-a-Ride, which provides a transport service for the elderly and disabled. And there is the photograph of Sophie Hacker perched in front of her window with the swirling blue and golden strips of stained glass.
And more about good deeds and good people, it's from the series of Chronicles of the Past, and it's headed A Century of Humanity in Action in Hampshire. And the top picture is of Red Cross volunteers, half a dozen or so of them, racing to their ambulances during the Great War. They're all lined up behind them. Hampshire Record Office, home of Hampshire County Council's Archives and Local Studies Service, is collaborating with the Balfour Museum of Red Cross History this spring. Together, they're telling the stories of some of the local people who've joined the Red Cross over the last 100 years, bringing help to people in this county and further afield in wartime and peacetime. At the height of the First World War, a 23-year-old woman, who had already lost her fiancé and two of her brothers in the conflict, while another had been wounded in France, enrolled in the British Red Cross. After initial training, she volunteered to go to France, against the wishes of her family, and took the place of a voluntary aid detachment, VAD, member, who'd been killed when a shell destroyed her ambulance. She was Edith Gammon, who worked initially with a field ambulance unit. And there's a little picture of Edith Gammon in her uniform leaning into the engine of her ambulance. So obviously a woman capable of looking after wounded vehicles as well as people. Her field ambulance unit collected the wounded from forward casualty clearing stations and taking them to hospitals. Later, she worked in a British Red Cross hospital in Vimereux, tending both British and German soldiers. She cooked and cared for patients and staff during the influenza epidemic at the end of the war and collapsed with exhaustion, which prevented her from going to Constantinople for further service as she had wished. During the 1930s, whilst bringing up a young family, she continued her Red Cross work, carrying out first aid and nursing duties. At the outbreak of the Second World War, she became a member of a first aid post in Portsmouth until it was bombed, and then moved to a hospital in Petersfield. After the war, she rose to the rank of commandant and continued her commitment to the work of the British Red Cross in Hampshire until she died in 1994. Edith's is a story typical of so many who came from a variety of different backgrounds and volunteered to provide humanitarian aid when it was needed most. Some even lied about their age, among them Marjorie Grigsby from Portsmouth. Questioned by the recruiting officer in 1916, she insisted that her age was 20. He wrote in the book, "Age 20, brackets, apparent age 16, close brackets." In fact, she was only 17. Within a matter of months, Marjorie was driving an ambulance in France and worked at a British Red Cross hospital in Rouen. An exhibition entitled Humanity in Action, telling the story of a century of services in Hampshire, is currently on show at the top floor of Hampshire Record Office on the corner of Sussex Street and Station Hill in Winchester. It is dedicated to the many thousands of volunteers who over the past 100 years have committed themselves to the humanitarian work of the Red Cross. We hope their courage and determination, frequently involving work in extremely difficult and dangerous conditions in this country and abroad, will inspire future generations. The display comes from the Balfour Museum, founded by Elizabeth Betty Balfour, OBE, almost 20 years ago. Betty was herself a mobile VAD during the Second World War and was director of the Hampshire branch from 1946 until 1991. She died in 1998. The exhibition can be seen until April the 21st, Mondays to Fridays, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., staying open on Thursdays until 8 p.m. in March and 7 p.m. in April, and Saturdays 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on bank holidays.
Hampshire education chiefs have been accused of failing to consult the public before expanding Winchester primary schools. Parent Governor Mark Menzies blasted the local education authority for ignoring its statutory responsibilities and said the failure showed an unimaginable contempt for pupils, parents, staff and residents. Speaking at a meeting of the full council, Mr. Benzie said, "If this had been done in error, it would have been bad enough. But the correspondence that I've received would indicate it was planned." His comments come as the county is planning to expand 6 city centre schools to create an extra 80 reception class places this September to cope with rising demand. Western School will take 30 extra pupils and increase from a 2-form to a 3-form entry primary, a 50% increase. Other schools earmarked for expansion include St Peter's Catholic, Winnell, All Saints, Highcliffe, Kingsworthy and Hairstock. The council was asked to comment, but failed to respond. However, a Department of Education spokesman confirmed councils are required to submit a statutory proposal for consultation if schools expand by more than 30 places or 25%. Last week, the local authority launched public consultations on expanding St Bede and Week primaries, both of which have already happened. 3 permanent classrooms are currently being built at St Bede, replacing temporary classrooms. The council website said the consultation is to confirm the permanent expansion of the buildings and no further enlargement is proposed. The school has expanded to a 2-form entry primary school of 420 pupils. Meanwhile, Week Primary School has accepted 60 reception pupils every year for the last 3 years, and the school has 4 temporary classrooms. The council said the statutory consultation is to make permanent the temporary enlargement to a 2-form entry primary school. And Mr. Benzie said, "Hampshire County Council failed to consult with the public when they were meant to, and as a result were able to keep quiet about the school places shortage in Winchester. If they had complied with their statutory obligations, the local community would have had time to demand proper investment rather than temporary buildings which will end up costing more in the long run. Now, while I'm glad that they have acknowledged their error, I really don't see why they're bothering to carry out consultation on a project, that is St Bede's, that's already half built. Meanwhile, the council has unveiled plans to build a new primary school in Winchester on the site of Rotherley Boarding School."
And this article says that there is a beer festival set to pull in the punters. Wickham's 8th beer festival is set for next month. The biannual event at the Wickham Centre runs on Saturday, April the 14th, and organisers hope to offer 40 different beers or ciders. They are still looking for more sponsors to come forward. An afternoon session runs from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m, and then the adults-only evening session is from 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. The last festival in September saw 600 visitors and raised more than £5,000. Charities supported this time are Sophie's Appeal, set up in memory of Sophie Barringer, who was diagnosed with cancer and died in 2004, aged 6. Also chosen to benefit are Genes for Genes, which funds research into genetic disorders and cares for afflicted families, and Trust 2000, which supports small community projects at home and abroad. Entertainment on the night comes from This Way Up, a blues-based band from the South Coast, and Jack Rabbit, a party band mixing classic rock and roll with blues and indie. Tickets cost £4 for the afternoon session, £7 for the evening, and £9 for the day. They can be bought at the door, subject to availability.
Putting their best foot forward for hospice. That's exactly what 10 people are doing in this picture here, bright smiling faces, and they are literally putting their left foot forward, waving it in the air, all lined up like a group of tiller girls, and some of them waving mostly yellow, some blue balloons. Because it's the most ambitious event in a Winchester charity's calendar. Last year saw more than 1,000 people take part. And now Naomi House Children's Hospice is asking people to put their best foot forward again to raise vital funds. The Clarendon Way Walk is the hospice's largest fundraiser and sees people walk 26 miles over countryside between Winchester and Salisbury cathedrals. But organisers are hoping this year's event, on June the 10th, will be bigger than ever. Participants can opt for a shorter 12-mile route from the village of Broughton to Salisbury instead. This year's event was officially launched by Winchester Cathedral's Reverend Canon Michael St. John Channel, who's pictured included in the group with the fundraisers, and he was taken part before. The Sutton Scotney Hospice provides respite, end-of-life, hospice at home and bereavement care to life-limited children, young adults and their families from across the South. It needs funds of around £5 million a year to carry on its work.
When a kind of hush fell over the city, the Titanic tragedy will be commemorated in Southampton with the opening of a new £15 million museum telling the largely untold story of its devastating impact on the city. The doors to the new Sea City Museum will open on April the 10th, marking exactly a century since RMS Titanic pulled away from the city's White Star dock to start what was to become her ill-fated maiden voyage to New York. 5 days later, 1,517 of her passengers and crew perished after she struck an iceberg and sank in the icy waters of the Atlantic. Nowhere was the impact of the tragedy more keenly felt than in Southampton, where more than 500 households lost at least one family member, and the vast majority were serving as crew members. The state-of-the-art Sea City Museum will feature the largest Titanic exhibition in Great Britain and is expected to attract 150,000 visitors a year. Built with the help of a £4.9 million lottery grant, the attraction occupies the former police station and old magistrates' courts at the city's 1930s Civic Centre. It will combine interactive experiences with the unique historical impact the tragedy had on Southampton, as well as first-hand accounts of the experiences of the crew, and a replica of their quarters on board Titanic. Around 4,000 items from Titanic will also be on display in the Sea City galleries. And among the interactive attractions, visitors will get to try their hand at steering the Titanic out of Southampton water using brand new video technology. And children can have a race to see who can shovel coal fastest into the Stoker's game, or pretend to be a wireless operator and have a go at Morse code in the Marconi room. One of the law courts will recreate the inquiry held in London after the ship sank, while the cold room will transport visitors to the night the ship went down with vivid historical oral accounts from Titanic survivors. And a walkable gangplank suspended in the air will recreate the excitement of the boarding experience at Southampton Docks. Something not to be missed.
This is entitled Village Craft Show Set to Fly. It is one of the biggest events in Osbury and is celebrating its 10th birthday. The village holds an art and craft show every 2 years, and the next one takes place this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, March the 24th and 25th. Joint organiser Fiona Nash said, "We are still keeping to our local roots, but this year even more Hampshire artists have been invited to join us to display their paintings and handiwork. The response to this year's event has been incredible, and we will be exhibiting a wide diversity of original work, including paintings of all media, photography, textiles, wood turning, fused glass, and much more. More than 30 artists will display their work at the Village Hall in Main Road and Osbury Primary School nearby. Youngsters at the school have been producing their own artworks leading up to the event, with a theme of birds and trees." Head teacher Elena Ponson said, "The children and staff are always looking forward to Arts Week. It gives us a chance to try new things and show people the wonderful opportunities available to our children." The school will also host a children's craft workshop on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. as part of the event. The wider exhibition will be open from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Saturday and 11 p.m. to 5 p.m. on Sunday. Entry costs £1. Any profits will be donated to Osbury and Morstead Community Association. And it is accompanied by a photograph of a group of a dozen or so Osbury primary school children with their tissue paper brightly coloured large birds that they've made as part of the art and craft show.
Council chiefs have bowed to public pressure for a chance to have their say on plans for playing fields in Alresford. New Alresford Town Council leader, Councillor Steve Middleton, agreed to hold a public meeting with more information on its plans for playing fields adjacent to Oldbury Park Recreation Ground after appeals from the public. He faced questions from residents on the issue at the annual town meeting at Alresford Recreation Centre last Thursday. The Town Council has been trying to provide rugby pitches on the site for more than 10 years to help address a shortage of land for children's play and sport locally. It is proposing to purchase nearly 4 acres of land at Oldbury Park and lease another 11-acre plot, 3.1-acre plot of land. The purchased land, the lower field, which needs to be levelled, would be used for recreation and would have a rugby pitch and practice pitch on it, giving Alresford Rugby Club a base in the town rather than playing in Byton. The meeting heard how the council had also been offered the lease on a 1.7-acre plot, but no use had been determined. This takes the total open space gained to more than 7 acres, which the meeting heard would virtually satisfy the current shortage. At the meeting, members of the public raised concerns about the plans, what they perceived as a lack of transparency and the danger of opening the way for more housing development. Councillor Middleton said at the meeting that at the moment it was purely an application for a change of use of the lower field land, from agriculture to recreational. And Councillor Margot Power said these were very early stages of the process. Councillor Roy Gentry stressed the plans did not use taxpayers' money, but developers' contributions, that if not claimed from the City Council, developers might try and get back. A public meeting will now be held in 4 to 6 weeks' time. City councillors have agreed in principle to the £185,000 scheme to build rugby pitches in Alsford. New Alsford Town Council asked the City Council Cabinet to provide cash to buy nearly 4 acres of land at Albury Park. At a meeting last Wednesday, the Cabinet agreed to the proposal and subject to approval by a Council Planning Committee at a later date.
Right, that's rugby. How about two more items of sport? Barton Stacey defeated their Whitchurch counterparts 3-0 away from home in the semi-finals of the Testway Youth League Supplementary Trophy. That's soccer, by the way. And they will play Alderbury in the final on April the 24th. So, Barton Stacey listeners, you're famous. And another sport, which is netball. A college netball team is celebrating after coming out top in the county. Eastleigh-based Barton Peveril College, their first team netballers, won the Hampshire Colleges League 2011-2012 championship title. They triumphed in a closely fought encounter with Itchen College, where they ran out 42-34 winners. Coach Alex Christopher said that her team deserved their success. The girls have shown excellent commitment to training and matches throughout the season, and they really gel as a team, she said. And with many of these students in their first year at Barton Peveril, this is only the beginning. And there is a very nice picture of the Barton Peveril netball team. An interesting thing to note, perhaps not relevant to netball though, is that every single member of the team has shoulder-length hair.
And still on school successes, Andrew Napier has written that school's chief hails college's maths success. Cabinet Minister Michael Gove visited Peter Simmons College to see the success of its maths department and express support for the campaign for a new primary school in the city. In an unannounced visit on Monday, the Secretary of State for Education chatted to teachers and students about their courses and the additional support given by the college. Since 2008, Peter Simmons has seen a 32% rise in the number of students studying mathematics. Currently, more than 1,000 are studying at AS or A level. Results are outstanding. More than half got A starred, A or B grades in 2011, and nearly all go on to university to study science or maths courses. At the end of his visit, Mr. Gove said, "Peter Simmons should be proud of its increasing numbers and successful results in the maths department. The staff are extremely committed and the students are thriving within this vibrant atmosphere." The Secretary of State also backed efforts to bring the new primary school to the city. As revealed by the Hampshire Chronicle, Winchester faces a severe shortage of primary places for this September. Mr. Gove said, "Steve Brine is absolutely right to tackle the problem of primary places head on and build a consensus that will deliver new permanent places to meet demand. Through our free schools policy, we have given communities, including Winchester, the tools needed to take control of the local situation, and there is no reason why a free school in the city could not develop and prosper." City MP Mr. Brine said Hampshire County Council expected this week to give the go-ahead for a consultation on a new school for 5 to 16-year-olds based on the Westgate School in full flood. a member of staff, who asked not to be named, said, "Whilst I would normally welcome a visit from the Education Minister, I am left feeling demotivated and manipulated in the way it was handled. This was the perfect opportunity for him to motivate frontline staff who are feeling battered and bruised from all of the changes going on. Instead, the visit was arranged in secret and no address was made to the staff." And there is a photograph of Michael Gove chatting to students in the college's resources centre.
"A not-a-born man illegally used his dead mother's out-of-date disabled parking permit and then tried to blame his dad, who had also just died. Peter McCormack claimed his late father had tampered with the expiry date on the blue badge after an eagle-eyed traffic warden spotted it had been faked. Mr. McCormack, 53... excuse me. Mr. McCormack, aged 53, told Southampton City Council investigators he knew he should not have used his mother's disabled permit more than a year after she died, but insisted he had no idea it had been altered. The silversmith of Greenacres Drive said he had not intended to cheat the pay and display charge when he parked in Southampton city centre to pop to an optician on September 14th last year. Instead, Mr. McCormack said he found the badge in the glove box of his Land Rover when he was looking for some change. Even though he knew the ticket machine in the Strand accepted credit and debit cards, he used the permit when he couldn't find any cash. But the Hampshire County Council issued blue badge did not contain any of the security features found on those that expire this year. The Southampton Magistrates Court, McCormack pleaded guilty to using a disabled badge for using a disabled badge when the vehicle was not being used by the person to whom the badge was issued. Prosecutor Mary Kigonya said the permit had been given to his mother, Kathleen, in 2006. She said the expiry date appeared to have been amended to read April the 12th, 2012. It transpired that Mrs. McCormack died in July 2010, but the badge hadn't been returned to Hampshire County Council. Ms. Kigonya added McCormack ignored an initial letter asking him to confirm who was driving the Land Rover on September the 14th, but did respond to a follow-up and was then interviewed. Mr. McCormack, who was unrepresented in court, offered no further mitigation, but told JPs, "I'm sorry, it was a foolish thing to do." The magistrates fined him £167, which they said had been reduced because of his guilty plea, and ordered him to pay £260 and a £15 victim surcharge.
A campaigner's anxious wait. Campaigners face an anxious wait to see if their bid to protect Bushfield Camp will be heard. They want to register the downland overlooking Winchester as a village green to ward off developers. On Monday, the church commissioners who own the site tried to have it struck out. Both sides faced each other in the County Council chamber in Winchester for the one-day hearing. The commissioners, represented by Jonathan Carras, QC, argued that the bid was flawed. It was made in 2008, just in time to meet a five-year deadline after the commissioners fenced off part of the site in 2003. To qualify as a village green, access must be unrestricted for 20 years. Bushfield Downs supporters group argues that it was for at least two decades before the fences appeared. And Mr. Carras said the application had details missing and the scale of the maps supplied was too small. He said, "We say the application has been received but has not been duly made. We would say the word duly means properly made for the purposes of this act." Campaigners argue that their bid is sound and inspectors are now reviewing the case. Barbara Guthrie of Bushfield Down Supporters Group said the group was expecting a decision sooner rather than later. The legal ruling is expected in around a month's time. If the campaigners win, a further hearing will be held later this year to decide if village green status can be granted. Bushfield Camp, which was a former army base until the 1970s, has previously been targeted by developers. It's been linked with supermarkets, housing, and more recently a knowledge park for high-tech firms. It is listed as an opportunity site in Winchester's draft 20-year district master plan. If village green status is secured, the land, which is popular with ramblers and dog walkers, would be made much harder to develop.
Thank you. And finally, just before we close, there's an item from Belgarum Diary, the alternative look at the news. It's headed "Dead Ringer by George." When Winchester City Council leader George Beckett announced that he was stepping down, Belgarum ruminated on what legacy he might leave. But immortalising himself in a portrait in the Guildhall, dressed as an 18th century dignitary, no, that's surely going too far. The spitting image of the councillor can be seen in a picture outside the Walton Suite on the third floor. Of course, it isn't really Councillor Beckett, but a likeness of a wealthy local merchant, James Cook, from 1780. Still, Belgarum reckons the likeness is uncanny, right down to the flowing silver locks. And that concludes the extracts for this week. So thank you to our editors, Margaret Boyden and Linda Vincent, and thanks to our copying, dispatch and memory stick preparation teams. And of course, it's thanks to our readers, Jane Harding.
Goodbye.
Graham Cranmer.
Goodbye.
And Bobby Sanderson.
Goodbye.
And from me, Keith Vincent, goodbye and do have an enjoyable week. And when you finish with this week's recording, please pop the memory stick back in the wallet and return it as soon as possible, placing the address label inside the wallet. Thank you.